Let me begin with a story about my father. That my father's joy was really spending time with his children and his grandchildren, and really spending time specifically with me when I was there with him. And after we made Aliyah, I worked, as you might remember, at Heichal Shlomo, which was just a couple of blocks away from him. So I would come. And I'd come for lunch pretty regularly, and it was amazing. Like, I'd walk in, and my mother would be like, "Oh, Ari, you know, please sit down. What can I get for you? You know, here's coffee. Can I make you, you want steak?" You know, it was like every time I came home, and it was very similar to when Anita would come to Neve Daniel. That's what I would do for her. And then we'd have lunch and we'd have time together. Almost every other day I'd be able to walk over and have lunch with them. That was their greatest joy, to spend so much time with me. And then the opportunity at Yeshiva University came, and they asked me at Yeshiva if I'd be interested in becoming the president of Yeshiva University, which would mean that I'd have to move from Israel to America and not see my parents for months on end. And my father said to me that you need to go. Like, you need to do this. It's just too important for the Jewish people. You know, you need to go. And even though it's a great sacrifice for himself, he knew he wasn't going to see me as much. Till the end, like, he knew he wasn't. He insisted that I continue at Yeshiva, knowing that he's in his last years, knowing that he wasn't going to, he did not think he was going to survive my term at Yeshiva. But that's what he thought was the right thing to do. He has always been incredibly supported, and he was surrounded then, as he is, as he was throughout his life, by my brother and sister who are watching right here. My brother Alex and his wife Chevy, and my sister Cheryl and Moshe, and of course by my mother And he found such strength and support, and he sent me here to do my work here. My father continues to animate and guide really everything I do. I have the image of Yosef, of the Diyukno Shel Aviv, of the image of my father when I make decisions, and he certainly stays with me, as he does with Alex and Cheryl and all of our spouses and our grandchildren. Today, I would like to do something unusual for Yahrzeit Shir, is discuss a central topic that is impacting our community specifically, and what has emerged from this leadership role at Yeshiva. I don't think when my father said, "You need to go back," he would have imagined that such a thing could have possibly have happened, as to what has happened. And I particularly have an insight into this, not just as the president of Yeshiva University, but more so because I actually have spoken to college presidents, dozens of college presidents around the country now. Over the past 4 or 5 weeks, I have been speaking a few times a day to college presidents from all different states, and have my finger on the pulse of this in a way that I am not sure that others have. And it's part of this effort that we started, which is to grow the list of college university presidents who stand with Israel against Hamas, and who are willing to say with moral clarity that Hamas is a terrorist organization. And from those conversations, and from the many reports that I've received from students and on campuses, from parents on campuses, from working with Hillel, with Chabad, with JLIC. So we've become a unique focus point of one of the major issues in the country today. And I'd like to share with you some observations about what's happening today. Frame the response in a Torah frame, which I think gives us direction of what we need to do in the country, that actually is emblematic of so many things that my father has stood for. So let me begin by telling you three points that are characteristic of our campuses today. The first is that this issue since the war is the single greatest issue that has divided college campuses in recent times. This is what college presidents report throughout the country. This has singularly divided the campus more than any other social issue, than issues of race, Me Too, gender. This is what has divided the college campuses more than they've never faced this situation before. Why is this so divisive? And a lot of them have explained that normally on college campuses, everyone chooses the same side, meaning there are very heavy, serious social issues, but everyone's on the same side of the issue. It's not divided. But here, for the first time, they have one set of students against another. And what they're finding, of course, is one set of students actually leading to language that is, and sometimes much more than language, that actual harassment against another group of students. You have students sitting next to each other with real tension, that there are campuses that are tinderboxes. That is the first thing. Number two, a second observation is the lack of moral clarity in our college leadership. There is a real paralysis on so many campuses for the president and the leadership to say clearly what is true, that Hamas is a terrorist organization. And what we insist on in our statement is that the Palestinian people are not represented by Hamas, but they are in fact harmed by Hamas. And because of this inability, because they haven't laid the groundwork for what is true, a lot of these campuses have actually flared up. Because what you have is many college students who are just kind and don't want to see other people suffer get caught up in language that is pro-genocide when they don't intend to. And therefore, the Jews experience this as a real attack against them. And if the universities were more clear from the get-go about what's true and creating the boundaries, then actually civil dialogue could happen between Israel and Palestinian. They can actually have a conversation about ethics of war and land. They just need to disentangle the piece of Hamas. And we'll talk about later why they're unable to do that, which has, I think, been the singular lack of leadership, the proactive leadership in this in the community. Has led to this spiraling situation. And the third thing is that anti-Semitism is real. I've had college presidents in states that will surprise you, where there are no, you wouldn't think that there'd be any unrest, who've said to me that anti-Semitism has been hiding, almost under a rock, and this has given an excuse for it to surface and get legitimization. And there's real Jew hatred. And because of all of these issues, the divisiveness, the lack of moral clarity, the anti-Semitism is being enabled to spread. And we have Jews today all throughout the country that are hiding their identity, removing their mezuzahs from their door. They don't want to be identified as Jewish. Certainly they've taken down the Israeli flags. But they're hiding their Magen David, their Star of David. They're tucking under their shirt. They're being erased. This is what's happening in college campuses all throughout the country. So what is it that could be our response? So I'd like to frame this in the frame of Torah perspective. We were in the book of Bereishis. If you remember, I used to teach here. We had a great class on Bereishis. It was like one of my my favorite activities. And we had, when we read through the story, Arthur, I think, brought brought dinner at the time, and we read through the stories of Bereishis, like with a literal understanding the pshat of the psukim. And we're told that Maisa Avot Siman Labanim, that the stories of the patriarchs and matriarchs, you know, resonate afterwards as a sign for the children. And I think that when it comes to the midot, the characteristics we find that actually can be helpful for us, there's a famous Zohar Midrash that said, "What are the characteristics of the Avot?" That each one of the Avot saw God through his own prism. And the Medrash says that Avram yadale migo chesed, that Avram saw God through the prism of chesed. That was his characteristic. And that Yitzchak saw God through the characteristic of gevura, which we'll talk about, of strength. And Yaakov saw God through the characteristic of emes. Titen emes le Yaakov chesed le Avraham. Through the characteristic of chesed. That Avram for emes. That Avram stood for chesed, that Yitzchak stood for gvura, and that Yaakov stood for emes. Chesed, gvura, and emes. And I think actually this is a framework that will help us, not just then, not just throughout history, but specifically right now, a framework of chesed, gvura, and emes. When it comes to chesed, what does it mean that Avram typified chesed? We know Avram, there are many things in Avram's life that you wouldn't have named chesed, including the wars that he fought, or expelling one of his sons, or even, of course, the Akedah. But Avram was typified by his open tent, which stood for something. It wasn't a tent where you came in and did whatever you wanted. It was a tent that stood for the values of the Torah, but it was open and reaching out to others. You know, one of the great expressions for me that I learned from my uncle about this was from the Pasuk, Ve'ere Lav Hashem Be'elonei Mamre. Now, the Pasuk says that God appeared to Avraham in Elonei Mamre after the bris, after the Mila. And Rashi asks, who is Mamre? Who is Mamre? God appeared to Avram in Elonei, which I think the English translates as terebinth, which obviously nobody knows what that means. But let's say the place of the plains of Mamre. Who's Mamre? And why is he appearing in the story that this is his place? So Rashi explains that Mamre was actually an ally. He was a friend of Avram. He was one of his non-Jewish friends. Avram had allies. He had friends. We know that he had friends and allies because when he went to fight in the wars, he brought his allies with him. And Mamre was one of them. And Avram was sitting in Elonei Mamre. He gave him, he hosted him. And it mentions Mamre, Rashi says, because Mamre gave him advice on the Mila. That's what Rashi says. Mamre gave him advice on the Mila. So my uncle, quoting Rabbi Soloveitchik, asks, what does it mean that Mamre gave him advice on the Mila? Avram wasn't going to do the Mila without Mamre? Avram needed Mamre to tell him to do the Mila? And the Rav explains that, of course, Avram was going to do a Bris Mila, but Avram was worried. He was worried that if he would do the Bris Mila, he would set himself apart from everybody else. Like this would be, he's already espousing new beliefs. This will physically set him apart from everybody else. And nobody would want to deal with him. And Mamre, his friend, said to him, Avram, you don't need to worry. We're still going to be your friends. But he says even more than that. Don't think that distinguishing yourselves by the Torah and by God's belief is going to separate yourself out. It's just the opposite. It is what attracts us to you. It is what makes you unique. The way that you embrace God's word. This is what makes us want to cling to you. The chesed of Avram is not just that he's kind and zachnasas archim and reaches out to other people, but he does so with a Jewish flavor that he's proud of. And that he expresses publicly. This is the chesed of Avram, which is what draws people to him. That is chesed, and we'll talk more about that. the gevura of Yitzchak is not obvious. You know, what strength did Yitzchak show? Yitzchak did not win battles. Yitzchak did not win wars. He was not, you'd think of him as a gibor. Not in the fields like that. So in what way was Yitzchak a gibor? So I think gevura in this case means resilience. The gevura, ezu gibor, akovesh es yitro, is somebody who knows himself and is able to conquer himself and be resilient through the difficult times. And Yitzchak had very difficult times. He had troubles with his brother, troubles at home with his children, problems with the Plishtim, and of course, the Akedah. You imagine going, being on the other side of the Akedah and what that would mean. But you wouldn't know it. You never saw a crisis of faith or uncertainty. And all the other avot, Avram asked Hashem, you know, but my edah, how do I know that this promise is going to come true? God says to Yaakov, don't be afraid when you go down to Mitzrayim, which means he was afraid. You never have anything like that for Yitzchak. Yitzchak is constant, he's resilient. He is a gibor that emerges from a deep emunah and confidence. That is the gvura of Yitzchak. And Yaakov is emes. And that's not obvious that Yaakov is emes. As we learned about and studied for many years when we studied Yaakov, Yaakov's life was filled with so much deceit, with Esav and hiding as Esav, with living in a house of Laban, slipping away in the middle of the night. What emerges from Yaakov is as an ish emet, is the moment when he confronts Esav. You remember, we spoke about this a lot. The Rashbam's approach with the Malach, what was the fight with the Malach? Was that Yaakov was setting up Esav. That he gave gifts to Esav. He was sending Esav and he was telling Esav, I'm coming back to Israel. And he was giving him gifts that they would one would follow the other like a mile apart and then a mile apart. And all of this was a ruse. So Esav would follow a certain path and he'd know exactly the way that Esav is attacking. And Yaakov, meanwhile, would slip out the other way. Like, this was just an example of Yaakov being clever and avoiding the confrontation that needed to happen. So the Malach came, and why was the Malach fighting with Yaakov? It was actually to hold him back and to injure him so he couldn't run away. And it forced Yaakov to face Esav. And it's only after he faced Esav that he became Yisrael. That this ish emet, this ish yashar, that emes was difficult. But he learned it and he became it. And he learned that you need to stand for truth. Even when it leads to difficult conversations and difficult situations. I think that this legacy of chesed, gvura, and emes is actually what exactly we need right now. Doing it in reverse order, first of all, we need to stand up for truth. We need emes. We need to be beacons of light. Israel is under attack, and we have a purpose here in America right now. There is a singular purpose in America for American Jews right now, which is to stand up for the truth, to speak out and tell Israel's story. Like, we're not, I mentioned before that my son was called to service, and we know, of course, we all know, us specifically in Neve Daniel, where we are in Gush Etzion, just around our block, there are about 40 to 70 sons who are right now fighting in Gaza. You know, we know that Israel's called to service, and in a much different way, we are all called to service. Like, every single day, we need to be thinking about what are we doing for Israel? What is our particular service? One thing that we could do is we're all ambassadors for the truth. And we all need to stand up for the truth and tell the story. And especially as it becomes more uncomfortable, it becomes more necessary for us to stand up for the truth. And we need to make sure that our students on the college campuses are able to stand up for the truth. It's not enough for presidents and college campuses to say, oh, we have a threat against the Hillel. Jews don't go to the Hillel. That's not the response. What about those responses when they say, everybody on the campus come to the Hillel? We're standing together with the Jews. Not Jews run and hide. That's what we've seen from college presidents now. There's a threat. Jews go hide. Like, we need our college presidents to actually say, not just that we're going to stop harassment, which is the lowest level that you would naturally expect. And what I've argued when I've spoken to interviewers is all we want is consistency on that score. However you would feel, however you would treat other social groups, just treat us. Like, it took some, without mentioning any university by name, I heard that it was after the second time that they violated the rules and harassed that they said, oh, this club can't meet for the semester. Was there any other social group that you would need a second time for that to happen? Like, just be consistent with your standards and make sure that our students aren't just safe, that they could hide and be Jews in their campuses, but they could stand up for the truth and be comfortable and secure in doing so. And the truth is what we need to hold accountable to our college campuses. I want to tell you, this is probably the key. This is the key, and I've tried to get this out, and we're going to continue getting the story out. There's a fundamental split about what college campuses is about. What is the purpose of education? So they will tell you that freedom of speech, we house freedom of speech. We can't say anything because we're a bastion of freedom of speech. And I explained to them, you know, freedom of speech is a vehicle. Actually, what university is about is seeking truth. Look at all the banners of Veritas and Urim Vetumim. Look at all your banners. What you're supposed to be about is seeking truth. Freedom of speech is a vehicle for you to get to the truth. But if you are actually focused on the truth, then when it hits you in the face, you can say it. That's the difference. It has to be built. This bastion of freedom of speech needs to be built on the foundational layers of intellectual integrity and moral clarity. So, for example, to be able to say that Hamas is a terrorist organization, not just say there was an atrocity. They're being congratulated for saying that there was an atrocity, that children were decapitated, women raped, and people burned alive. They're being congratulated to say that. It's not about one atrocity. It's an organization with a charter that says their purpose is to kill all the Jews. You should be able to call that out and separate that out from the Palestinian cause. Let there be Israel-Palestinian conversations. But Hamas is a terrorist organization. We need to insist on the truth. The truth that our students are able to speak it securely, and that the presidents and leadership of our universities say it explicitly and call it out. That's not against freedom of speech. And if the University of Chicago rules don't allow that, it's wrong. I don't know if you're following these University of Chicago rules, but it's the only thing in the university now that is not interrogated. Everything else is held under scrutiny. The only thing that's not is these University of Chicago rules that conveniently is being applied when it comes to the Jews. Like, they are making other statements by a lot of other situations, except for this one. So there's a real need for us to focus on truth for our students and for the leadership of universities, and to hold them responsible for that. Second is gvura, is resilience. It's not easy. There's real anti-Semitism. How do we teach resilience for our students? So I just had a conversation with a father of a hostage. He was a good friend of mine. Crazy. I mean, crazy. We're like one step. I'm explaining to presidents around the country. Like, we are one step. Every single one of us is one degree of separation from somebody who was killed, taken hostage, or shot down in the line of duty. Like, we all know somebody. So I asked this father, I mean, this crazy, a regular guy. His son is a hostage right now. This isn't mourning for the past, right now. I said, how do you, I'm like, I'm having trouble during the day. Like, I'm like it's hard. Like, how are you doing this? And he said to me that he gets comfort from the fact that he knows he's not alone. That there are other hostage families, but more so all of Klal Yisrael. Like, he feels the chibuk. Literally, this is what he said to me. He feels the hug of all of Klal Yisrael. And that he doesn't know how people do these things alone. Like he said, I don't know how people go through tragedies alone. Like, I can't even imagine it. But I'm getting through this because I'm not carrying this alone. You know, it's really funny. I listened to it. It was really, it's just such chizuk. So before Shabbat, a local New Jersey yeshiva sent us cards. Sent us a babka and cards for my son in the army. And they said to him, they actually got the wrong son, but it doesn't matter. But they wrote his name and they said, we're praying for you, we're davening for you, and we're thinking about you. And actually it gave me real, being on the other side, like, and I didn't even think of myself on the other side of that. And it really is, it's really helpful. It's like the sense of, and we saw him when we were there, when Anita and I were there together, we brought over to our son a carload of food and supplies. Like, we found out he was going from the south to the north. We found out where we could meet him in the middle. We told our neighbors we're meeting them, and everybody piled in stuff. And we drove it over to him. What was amazing is when we got there, we weren't the only ones. So many people were there. And people would give cards about flying in from America, and it really is touching. Like, all the things that's happening here, that people are doing and the packing, it's really touching. I'll tell you something a little scary. My son just said to me, you know, the supplies are actually, they didn't need anything, he said, but he's starting to feel like they're getting less of it now. You know, as it's becoming, the war is becoming longer. Like, we can't, you know, there was a sense of urgency in the beginning, but we can't lose that sense of urgency because the urgency is the spirit of solidarity, of support. Like, that really is the way to teach our children, Gevura, in the college campus and beyond is to let them know that we're in this with them together. And I have to say, there is one bright light is the way that people are working together now in America. All the organizations, all the divides and then the politics, like, there's none. You know, I've been with Hillel and Chabad and JLI, like, we're working all together on these college campuses, the ADL. It's all like everybody's working together. You know, you see just the Conference of Presidents and JFNA, they said there's a rally. I'm like, okay, fine, we're canceling school. You know, and they were like, they needed the domino and they needed something to fall. So I'm like, okay, they told me on Friday we canceled all our classes on Sunday. And they cheered, you know, because then they were able to continue down and the yeshiva were, you know, had the matir, had the permission to come. But it's all this like, everybody working together, just trying to figure it out, you know, and that's the resilience that we're in this together. And finally, the chesed. I just want to say the chesed isn't just for inside the Jewish people. It's outside the Jewish people. And this is so important to know is that the Jewish people are not alone. We are not alone in this. We're not the only ones. There are people in our country, in our world, that stand with us, that see the truth and speak with moral clarity. That's why I started this. And we found over 100 college presidents. Literally just now, I didn't answer it, but the chancellor of SUNY just called me, who's the former Secretary of Education for President Obama, who's with me side by side, to talk about how we stand together with Israel against Hamas, that Hamas is a terrorist organization. Some of my most inspiring conversations, like Mamre said to Avram, that don't worry, like we're here with you. Some of my most inspiring conversations have been these past weeks. It was one woman from HBCU. We have our coalition is major private and public universities, faith-based universities, historically black colleges, universities. One woman from one of the historically black colleges, she said to me when I was so distraught in the beginning, she said, Ari, the Jews win when Moses holds up his hands in prayer. But who is holding Moses' hands? It's Aaron and Hur. We are Aaron and Hur. You can lean on us. We're here for you. And I think it's so important for the Jewish community to know that we need to find new partners. If your universities have failed you, there's a lot of reasons for it, a lot of macro reasons that it's going to be very, almost impossible to change. They're going to do the president playbook of putting a task force and some projects and getting the Jews to pay for the projects. They're going to do all those things. But the macroeconomics of it, the macro trends, are very hard to fight against. But there are other partners, and we have to find them. We have to find the angels, not just put to task, those that are coming up short. And that is an essential. That's an essential effort, and that's the chesed. It's reaching out to others, not just internally but externally. And they know this, by the way. They know that today it's us. The spotlight's on us, but tomorrow it could be very easily on another group. Like, they know that, if they first come for the Jews. So this is three-part of how to deal with this, which is MS insisting on the truth, insisting that our students are able to speak the truth in their campuses and that the university leadership speaks the truth. Two, we have to teach resilience of our next generation, which you can find internally when working together, that you're not alone, we're with each other, which also comes hand in hand with a deep sense of emuna and faith in our future. And three, the chesed, not just inside but outside, like Avram stood for with Mamre, of finding the partners. For my father, I think these three traits are his character. So much speaks about his character. My father, with chesed, really always helped others in need. If he had it, you would have it. I remember there's some story where he was short. He was starting a company, and he needed, let's say it was $50,000 at the time. And some investment hit, and he was able, and he got that $50,000. And that day, like, a friend of his called, and his friend was so distraught and he needed the money. And my father said, what do you need? And he said, I need $50,000. I was like, okay. And he just gave him the $50,000. Like, that was like my father's, like, if he had it, you would have it. And he had very little sense of his own, of material goods. He was always happy to share. I remember when we made Aliyah, so my father made Aliyah the year before we did. And you put all your stuff on a lift. Remember the lifts? You put your stuff on a lift. So my father had a matching set of very expensive couches. And when he was doing his lift, so he gave us one. We had it in our apartment, in Rabbi Levine's apartment. And so it was a very nice couch. And then there was a second couch he was going to take with him to Israel. So when they started loading the lift, and it was getting full. So the movers were having trouble putting the couch into the lift. So my father said, you know what, to one of the movers, he said, you keep it. So the only reason I know that is because the next year we made Aliyah, and the movers came to pack our lift, and the mover comes and says, hey, I have a couch just like that one. So this is my father. And whatever anybody needed, and certainly whatever we needed, like if we needed anything, there wasn't even, there was nothing that my father wouldn't do, you know, whether it's driving anybody around, material goods, financial help, anything we needed, you know, my father was always there. That was his purpose. Like that's what he felt was his purpose, was to help ensure that his family had everything he wanted. My father, when it came to Gvura and resilience, my father was an entrepreneur. He founded companies and started things. Some would work and some would not work. And there's a lot of ups and downs. Like in my life, it was a lot of ups and downs. And I wouldn't know it. Like growing up, I would not know it. You know, it was just like, to me, it was very even keel. But afterwards, finding the stories, I mean, lots of ups and downs. And my father always taught me that you can't be sentimental about things that happened in the past. Meaning if you bought something, say you bought a stock and the price is down now, like you can't think about what it was. You just have to make a decision on what it is now. Like there's no place for what you bought it for. It doesn't matter. Like you have to know, look your situation in the eye, and you have to deal with it. And the kind of thing that my father did is he always had big dreams. And this was part of his secret to his resilience. He always had big dreams. And he always was able to create. He was very creative. So a friend of mine, somebody who was older than me, younger than my father, who called me during the Shiva to tell me the story. He said he always looked up to my father as a kind of father figure. His father was a rabbinic figure. My father was in business. So he always felt connected to my father. He was more of a business. And he said that he met my father once, and my father was so upset that he was in this major deal that was looked like it was going to be great, and it went under due to somebody doing something inappropriate, like somebody like did something to him, and it pulled the deal down. And my father, he saw, was so upset. The next week he saw him, my father was smiling, he was happy, and he was telling him about this great new idea that he's working on. Right, and he said, that's the sense of riding life's ups and downs and the resilience and the belief and the continuity that we're going to do something big, we're going to do something meaningful, you know, and never get too stuck in the past, but always believe in the future. And finally, when it comes to MS, my father did not hide how he felt. You know, as a rabbi, you know, I'm very diplomatic. My father is less diplomatic. And you would know how he feels. It's interesting because this past month, I've been so distraught and so not myself. I've actually been very much less diplomatic. And I've enjoyed it more, I have to say. I've been telling people exactly how I feel. I sort of get it now. I sort of get it. But anyway... but more than him standing for truth, you know, he always supported institutions that believed in truth. Like he was the president of our yeshiva, he was the president of our shul. He was a major donor to the Jewish Center. I just saw his name on the plaque for our campaign, which shows not just his belief in the Jewish Center, but also obviously supporting his son from the very beginning. More so, he put all of us on a path of truth of Torah and mitzvos, and he encouraged us to accomplish. He didn't have a prism. It was to find out who we were, to be true to ourselves, and to support us in the direction. And that is what has enabled Baruch Hashem, please God, his children, grandchildren, to become the people that that we are. You know, this past week leading up to the yard site, I've been reliving some of the most painful days in my life. Like that week leading up to his passing, my father was in the hospital. I flew in. I was told it did not look good. I had to get there. I flew in. on a Sunday. I landed there Monday, went straight to the hospital. Anita came in, all of our children, all of the grandchildren, wherever they were from around the country and the world. And we had that last week with him. My father, characteristic of him, really was able to face his reality square on. Like, he didn't hide from the truth. He didn't think he was, he knew he wasn't coming home. I didn't want to believe that. I came in and he said to me, okay, now that you're here, I could say goodbye. That's literally what he said to me after when I came from Israel. I'm like, no, Dad, we're going to fight it. We're going to fight it. So he spent that week making sure that we were ready and that my mother would be okay. Watching right now my brothers Alex Chevy and Charlotte Moshe and other members of my family, all of us came together that week. It was such a difficult time. He passed away on Shabbat morning, and we had the Shabbat together. The way in which our family has come together is exactly what my father would have wanted. The one who, of course, has felt my father's loss the most is my mother. My mother and father met each other at, it's interesting, my father was the president of the Yeshiva University Student Council, and Dr. Belkin, who was the president of Yeshiva University at the time, asked him if he'd participate and lead the 75th convocation celebration of Yeshiva University. So he introduced him to the president of Stern College Student Council. That is my mother. So my parents were both the respective presidents, and their shadchan was the president of Yeshiva University. And from that moment, they built their life together with their children and grandchildren. They had great triumphs and trials, great joy and challenges. They were with each other through the day-to-day and the exciting moments in life, and I think my mother would certainly say it was not boring. But very eventful, filled with much love and much life. And as he passed, with the tremendous loss that we felt, we also felt the blessing of him, of having so much time with him and him being with us. I'll close with something that happened to me. At the end of his life, you know, I've been here with you through many years, and there have been some times of end of life situations, and I found it rare, but at times I said the vidui with those who are ready to pass, who are close to passing. It's a very rare situation because you don't want to. You don't want to help the person, you don't want to move him along or her along. So, like, when do you say it, when do you not say it? It's very sensitive. But there was a point for my father where I was clear that it would be helpful to him for him to know that we were ready. Like, that's what he really wanted to know, that we were ready. So I led my father in the vidui. And he repeated after me, saying the Shema. And these were some of the last words of his life, was saying the Shema with me. And I couldn't help but remember when I was a boy. And my father led me in Shema. And how life opens and closes and is surrounded by Shema. Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. Our MS, our truth, the resilience of when Shema has been said throughout our history, at what points it's been said, and the chesed that we spread it to ourselves, to our children, to others. And because he taught me Shema, and because he taught us Shema, how many generations and generations and generations, through his work, through the work of all the organizations and shuls and schools that he supported, all the work of his children, everything that happens at YU and the generations after that, how many more children are now going to say Shema because of his Shema? He was blessed with the relationship with his generations, with each of his grandchildren, and with this I'll close. Each of his grandchildren, except for the youngest ones who have not yet reached the age, each of them have served Israel as chayilim, or in Sheirut or Sheirut Lumi. He has two grandchildren right now who are serving in the army. He has two grandsons-in-law who are in the army. We are sure that he is being a Melech Yosher, as a divine advocate for the safety of his grandchildren and for the all of Israel and all of Am Yisrael. My father sent me to Yeshiva University. Whatever I do here, whatever we all do, it continues what he taught us. And that to me is the greatest bracha, the time we had together and the ability to continue his memory. I thank you so much for being our friends and the comfort that your presence and words bring. Tovia ben Harav Chanoch, Tehei Nishmato Tzura, B'Tzur HaChayim. Thank you.